Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. On October 10th, the 21-year-old white man who confessed to the Walmart shootings in El Paso pleaded not guilty to charges that he gunned down and killed 22 people. Eight of the 22 victims were Mexican nationals. Today's guest, journalist Alfredo Corchado, reports that dozens of injured victims and family members of those slain in the biggest racially driven attack against Latinos in recent memory watched in silence. Alfredo Corchado will give us an update of how people are doing in El Paso on today's show. We will also discuss his new book, Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. Homelands chronicles the story of Mexican immigration to the United States over the past 60 years, U.S. immigration policy, and the devastating impacts of NAFTA on Mexican workers and farmers. Alfredo Corchado is Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, where he covers U.S. policy in Latin America. He's also author of Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey, which chronicles his experience covering the drug war in Mexico. And his most recent book is called Homelands. And Alfredo joins us from El Paso. Hi, Alfredo. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Good morning. Great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you, Alfredo. I really enjoyed reading your book and learning more about you and your family and your circle of friends. And before we talk about your book, I wanted to ask you about what has happened in El Paso since that horrific shooting on August 3rd, where, like I said, 22 people were killed, another 24 were injured. The goal of this young 21-year-old was to kill as many Mexicans as possible. Now, on Wednesday night, there was a police shooting outside the store, which left shoppers stuck inside, which must have been so frightening. How is the city doing overall, Alfredo? What are you hearing from people?
I think there are two sides. I mean, publicly, there's a campaign, you know, El Paso Strong. There's, I guess, a whole slogan, a whole trying to make people feel that nothing will define, you know, not the August 3rd shooting will define El Paso as who we are, what the city is all about. But the other side is that it's a city that's still struggling, I mean, it's coping with the trauma. I mean, there's a lot of people with PTSD. You mentioned the other day at Walmart. I mean, it's like any time people go to big stores with their families, whether it's the shopping mall, there is that sense of tension. There is a sense of nervousness. That this will happen again. This was, you know, when it happened, it was widely believed, and I think people still believe that in many ways it was a result of much of the rhetoric that's coming from the White House, and that hasn't really stopped. And with 2020 around the corner, people are still jittery, they're still jumpy that that the border will become again a target of people trying to make a statement.
We'll talk about the White House in a minute, but before we do, you wrote a piece for the Dallas Morning News about the shooter pleading not guilty, and you write that one of those in the courtroom, one of the either injured victims or family members, there was about 140 people there, including Sylvia Saucedo. The sight of the killer teared her up. She said she remembers seeing him walking inside Walmart from the knees down. She heard him shooting. She crawled under a table and pulled her 91-year-old mother alongside her, took out a cell phone, and recorded the chaos that ensued. And Alfredo, this, I remember watching this video, and it was just horrific. It got a lot of attention on social media. And she said that when she walked into the courtroom, quote, "Suddenly I was back inside Walmart. All the memories came back to me. This was very hard, very painful." So how is someone like Sylvia getting help for this? Is there any money set aside for therapy and help with PTSD?
Well, the city says that they have set money aside, and they are helping many people go through you know, the grieving process, just processing what happened. The bad part is that the victims from Mexico are not getting that kind of treatment. They're not getting any kind of help. The Mexican government has not, you know, it's not clear to us why that hasn't happened, but there's been an effort. This week there was a Senate hearing, a Texas Senate hearing, where the local DA, district attorney, did call on members of the committee to consider providing funds from the Compensation Victims Fund to the Mexican victims. I mean, as you said, there were eight people who were killed from Mexico and dozens more injured. Some of them are still, I know of at least one that's in the hospital, but several of them are still trying to, you know, deal with their injuries. And they live in Juarez, or they live in El Paso, but they go back and forth. If you live on the border, it's really, you know, it's in many ways it's still one community.
So you have, like you said, this meeting took place with these Texas senators, and the El Paso mayor, DeMargo, said Mexican victims of the shooting should be considered for the Victims Compensation Fund. Is there any update on that?
No update. I mean, these meetings are ongoing. Mm. They won't decide on anything for a while. But what did surprise me at that meeting was when the representatives of Mexico did come up and acknowledge that there wasn't much being done. There was not enough being done on part of the Mexican government. And I've talked to a couple of victims who are trying to get help, you know, for their relatives. I know one person who's remains in the hospital and probably won't be out till early next year. And I mean, they're getting by the help of relatives or friends on both sides of the border.
Wow. I mean, we were talking about therapy, but when you're in the hospital for that long, and not only do you need multiple surgeries, but then you need a lot of physical therapy, and then finally you deal with the emotional aspects of it. This is very expensive. And what's so sad, Alfredo, is so many of these shootings, people don't have the money to pay. And so, like you said, they rely on family and crowdfunding in many cases.
That's right. I mean, one of the victims, this is probably the better known victim who lost his wife, Maggie, mm. Antonio Bosco. I mean, there was a crowdsourcing fund that helped them. I mean, there was a car dealership that provided a brand new car, et cetera. He's still going through, you know, a lot. I mean, he still shows up every day at the memorial outside of Walmart and prays for his wife. He was recently caught they're saying DFW, drunk driving, but he wasn't driving. He was in the car, and obviously he's still coping very hard with over the loss of his wife.
Wow.
So I mean, these stories are still going. Again, that goes against the narrative of, you know, El Paso strong and so forth. I mean, it's hard to tell people, you know, just muscle through it. It's a long, long process. And now, as the holidays approach, I talk to victims, you know, it really hits them even harder.
Alfredo, we're hearing a lot of static in your line. Have you moved in the room at all? Because when you started, there was no... Okay, then hopefully we'll get a... It seems to be going in and out. Sorry about that. We're talking to Alfredo on a cell phone. What has the local reporting been like in the area, Alfredo, when it comes to, you know, following these issues to make sure that this continually gets the coverage it deserves?
Well, I don't... At least our paper, I mean, the Dallas Morning News, I mean, we're putting a lot of resources. Obviously, the shooter was North Texas, so it's a big story for us in Dallas, but also I'm on the border, I'm in Mexico, and it's a huge story. But I think everybody's trying to pitch in as much as we can. I mean, we realize the magnitude of the story. I mean, this is huge. And as you said it from the beginning, it's racially motivated. It was the largest massacre targeting Mexicans and Mexican Americans in recent U.S. history. That hasn't been lost on us. I mean, obviously the border, there's so much going on, but I know that at everything that happens, I mean, we're there as much as we can. You know, we know this is going to be a long, long story to cover for many months, if not many years.
And do major newspapers have reporters on the border?
We are probably the largest newspaper. I mean, the Dallas Morning News. But we have other reporters, freelancers, or correspondents who come in and out over time. El Paso has become like the big epicenter in the last two, 3 years. So it's not surprising to see major reporters from making newspapers, coming in from New York, coming in from D.C., other areas. I mean, this is the place to be in many ways.
Hmm. I just want to ask you, since you brought up the White House and the racist rhetoric that we're hearing, the very dangerous rhetoric coming out of the White House, Beto O'Rourke is getting a lot of attention because he says that Trump's response to a rally attendee who shouted, and I hate to even say these things on the air, but I think it's very important, who shouted that Americans should kill undocumented immigrants, of course they use the word illegal, led to the shooting in El Paso. So what happened is, at a rally in Florida in May, he explained methods to basically, how people are coming into the country. And he asked the crowd, how do you stop these people? And someone in the crowd said, shoot them. And he laughed. And so Beto O'Rourke is saying this leads to shootings. And of course, the right-wing media is going after Beto. But what about this dangerous rhetoric, Alfredo? And as, we head into the 2020 campaign season, what are you expecting? And how should the media cover these? What we hear from these rallies.
Rose, what happened August the 3rd, I think a lot of reporters were really not that surprised. I wasn't surprised at what happened because I had heard the rhetoric, becoming increasingly vile and increasingly nasty, ugly, that I kept thinking something is going to happen. I mean, something's going to explode. A month before the shooting, I was covering there was a press conference by the Hispanic congressional delegation outside of the Clint Detention Center in Clint, Texas, and it was the congressional delegation along with members of the so-called squad, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez and others were there, and it was incredible when you had the supporters of President Trump. They kind of surrounded the area, so you had the Trump supporters on outside, you had the media in between, and then you had members of the press conference speaking about what was going on. You couldn't really hear much of what they were saying because the yelling, the screaming was such that I kept thinking something's going to happen. And then this person right next to me, a professor, I kept seeing a bulge over her stomach, and I didn't see a gun, but I got increasingly nervous, and I talked to the police officer who was next to me, and I said, this person may have a gun. And he looked at me and said, it's open carry. We can't do anything about that. But I walked away thinking, this is going to get, I didn't think it was going to get bloody bad, but this is going to get really bad. I mean, and I've always felt that either politicians were going to be targeted or journalists were going to be targeted. Mm-hmm. When August 3rd happened, obviously it was devastating. But, in the back of my head, I kept thinking, this was coming. I mean, all this was leading to it. The rhetoric of stop the invasion. They're criminals, coming in. All that leads to consequences. Mm-hmm. I mean, stuff doesn't just happen. The shooter is a 21-year-old male from North Texas. I mean, you think, okay, he was 18 at one point. It's 3 years that when the current administration took office, and this is the kind of language that we've heard over the last 2 or 3 years. It's not. It's not surprising that he said, I came to here, to El Paso, to kill Mexicans, to stop the invasion of Texas.
Mm. And Alfredo, can you repeat that? When you said to someone, I think this person has a gun, who were you talking to?
I was talking to a local police officer there in Clint. They had police officers near the congressional delegation. Things were really tense. And so they were there, sort of protecting the crowd, protecting the legislators. But and the media was squeezed in between them and the supporters President Trump.
I mean, this is amazing. So you basically express concern to a police officer saying, I think this person has a gun. And the police officer said, we can't do anything because this is an open carry state.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
You know, I think, as you say, it's you didn't expect this, but I think it's so important to acknowledge just how unusual this is. I was recently overseas, and I met people in Europe. Every single person I met said, I cannot believe the gun violence that's happening in your country. In so many countries in Europe, you cannot buy guns.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid that we become used to this, desensitized to this. This is just not the way things work in other countries.
Right. I mean, and when you're on the border, I mean, you see the consequences on both sides of the border. Mm-hmm. Obviously, El Paso was kind of like the oasis. You know, if you live on the border and you're next to Ciudad Juarez, where people have gotten used to, you know, the killings that we've seen over the last 10 years or so, El Paso's always been the haven, you know, the place to go to and feel safe. But to see this and to have experiences, I mean, it just shatters your world.
Mm.
It's no longer, you know, this safe little haven.
Today we're speaking with Alfredo Corchado, who's Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, where he covers U.S. policy, and he's out with a new book. Really an incredible book called Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. And the book tells the story of Mexican immigration to the United States over the past 60 years. It also explores U.S. immigration policy, the devastating impacts of NAFTA on Mexican workers and farmers, and Alfredo also tells his own story. So if you have any questions for Alfredo about covering the border, and how you think the media should cover the language that we hear from this administration. With the impeachment hearings starting, you know that Trump is going to take it to the next level because that's what he always does. So how should the media cover this very violent and dangerous rhetoric that we hear on a regular basis? And if you have any questions for Alfredo about how people in El Paso are doing, he's been covering that extensively. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Alfredo, just not to spend more time on Trump, but how do you think the media should cover the rhetoric? Because you know he's going to take it to a new level as the election nears.
Well, that's the concern here in El Paso, and I think along the U.S.-Mexico border is that when things go bad in Washington, especially with this administration, the border becomes a piñata. Mm-hmm. You know, they will take it out and score brownie points by, you know, the rhetoric on the border, actions at the border. So I think people are thinking, okay, we're about a year away, so this is going to get even nastier. I mean, as reporters, you know, I'm a Mexican-American reporter. I'm born in Mexico. It's very, very easy for anyone to assume, you know, this guy is not objective. And at times, you know, especially when they're targeting you, I think my sense is I have to try even harder to try to get both sides of the story. It's, you know, whether you're white, you're African-American, you're Asian, you're Hispanic, and you're a reporter, I mean, there is that tension right now with the public, you know, the perception that we are enemies of the people and so forth. But as a Mexican-American reporter, I have to try even harder to try to convince people to talk to me, to try to get their stories.
Mm.
And so you know, I see a lot of colleagues who say, well, you know, the hell with that. We just got to tell the story. And tell how bad this administration is. I take it the other way around. I think I got to try harder to convince people that their stories matter and they have to trust me. And I have to get both sides of the story. And my bias, most likely, I mean, I'm an immigrant. I can feel it, but I try as hell to be objective. I try as hell to be, you know, to get both sides of the story, to get as many voices as possible into my stories.
Today we're speaking with Alfredo Corchado, author of Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. Alfredo, let's talk about what is happening on the southern border. You know, for those of us who don't live there, have not been there, we hear a lot about what happens. We hear about how the border has been militarized over the years. Can you give us a sense of what that means exactly?
Well, as I'm talking to you right now, I mean, there are helicopters in the air. I mean, it oftentimes it feels like it's a police state, you know. Mm-hmm. You have helicopters. People are a lot more wary about ICE agents, Border Patrol agents. You know, this is a community that you know, sort of comes together on both sides of the border. This is a community where a lot of mothers and fathers have daughters and sons who are members of the Border Patrol. So you kind of learn to coexist. That coexistence has sort of been, you know, tearing apart over the last 2-3 years. People are incredibly mistrustful of authorities. There's a sense that you know, they're going to go after you just because you happen to be Mexican American or a member of the other. So there's always a sense of tension, and I feel that even more like when I visit Dallas, for example, or other cities, and that's gone, and you know, you don't feel that sense of pressure on you. But when you're on the border, I mean, you have to sort of you know, in many ways, bear the situation. This, in many ways, this El Paso, Juarez, the border, has always been sort of a peek into the future. And I mean, it's a bi-national, bilingual, bi-culture community. And at times you feel like, you know, that's why they're targeting border residents.
Mexico is stopping asylum seekers and migrants from going to the U.S. after Trump threatened Mexico with tariffs. What do you make of this? Jorge Ramos, anchor for the Univision Network, had a piece in June in the New York Times called "The AMLO Trump Deal is Punishing the Most Vulnerable." And by AMLO, he means Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the president of Mexico. He says the new U.S.-Mexico immigration agreement may slow down the Central American immigration wave, but won't stop it because it's simply too powerful. What are your thoughts?
I think President Andrés Manuel López Obrador essentially built a human wall for President Trump. I mean, I never imagined in my life as a reporter that I would see the National Guards. I mean, you have 27,000 guardsmen on the northern border trying to keep away Central Americans and other migrants from coming into the U.S. And they're coming to the U.S. Not to be chased, not to run, but to turn themselves in and seek asylum. But when I'm in Juarez and I see them, you know, preventing them from crossing, you're basically seeing a human wall built. It's disturbing for a lot of human rights activists, you know, to see that. I think for border residents to see that, and it's also comes at a time when Mexico has these incredibly challenges, you know, with drug violence. So instead of the National Guard trying to keep Mexicans safe and trying to restore security in the country, they're chasing families and their children who are simply trying to seek asylum in the United States. It's a pretty disturbing sight.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're speaking today with Alfredo Corchado, Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News and author of the book Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by Alfredo Corchado, Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, where he covers U.S. policy in Latin America. He's the author of Midnight in Mexico, A Reporter's Journey, and his most recent book is Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. Alfredo was born in Mexico, and his new book, Homelands, tells the story of his life, his family, his community. It also takes a look at the devastating impacts of NAFTA, and the story of Mexican migration over the past 60 years. If you have a question or a comment for Alfredo, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And I apologize for some of the static on Alfredo's line. We decided to bring him on a cell phone because he's on assignment. Alfredo, we were talking about AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. You know, he came to power on a very progressive agenda. He promised to take on systemic poverty, corruption, and violence in Mexico. And a lot of people were surprised that he's working so closely with Trump on immigration policies. Alfredo?
Hello?
Hi, sorry about that. Go ahead.
I think his own administration is surprised as to how closely they have to work with the Trump administration. I mean, in talking to officials, they say, look, you know, it's the reality of the relationship is really coming true with a figure like President Trump, a mercurial figure who, and at any point, can put a tweet and mess with the Mexican economy. Their concern with the tariff threat was that, if he went through it, they could lose up to 200,000 jobs in Mexico. And so I think they feel really forced to try to get along, try to coexist. But if you notice, I mean, President López Obrador has been very careful in not to have this photo op with President Trump. He's trying to stay away as much as possible, and still try to have communication, try to work things out. But obviously, what happened in El Paso was a big wake-up call, not just for Mexican-Americans in the United States, but especially for the Mexican government. And there's only so much you can do with Trump. I mean, you can't, as one Mexican official said, you can't give the house away, because he may come back and make you pay for that.
Well, how is AMLO doing on these other issues when we're talking about poverty, corruption, and violence in Mexico?
It's important to know that President López Obrador came into power for two main reasons. I mean, he promised to end corruption. Well, actually, three reasons. Like, end corruption, restore security, and try to make Mexico a much more equal country between rich and the poor. It's too early to say, you know, whether he's failing or whether he's doing well. But I think my surprise is a couple of weeks ago I took a bus tour towards the center of Mexico and traveled, and it was interesting to see how Mexicans are they don't regret voting for President López Obrador, but you begin to see discontent, disappointment. And people begin to feel, okay, when's he going to really turn things around? When will we see something getting better? At this point, the homicide rate is still going up. And we've seen 3-4 incidents in the past few weeks that make people really wonder, does he have a plan, for example, to restore security? What's going to happen to corruption? I mean, he's made so many promises that I think it's going to be difficult for him to do what he said he would do. I think Mexicans are realistic. I mean, many say, look, if he can do just a little bit, improve security, end corruption, even just a bit, I mean, we will give him a passing grade. But he's in the first year of a 6-year term, and I think people are beginning to wonder, not that we do the wrong thing, or the right thing, but when do things really start improving in Mexico?
I'm sure we can assume that Obrador, President López Obrador, and his fellow government officials are watching what's happening in Chile right now, with massive uprisings against neoliberal policies. I mean, I was watching interviews with some young Chileans who said, we're being paid third world wages, and yet because so much has been privatized in this country, in order just to get the basics like water and electricity, it costs first world. We have first world bills, and we just can't make ends meet.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's what's, one of the things that people, voters, liked about López Obrador, is that he acknowledged that neoliberal policies, you know, were not all that great for Mexico, that it needed to do more to close the gap of inequality. And so I'm sure people are watching very closely what happens there. You know, will that have an impact in El Bajío? For example, El Bajío is the central part of Mexico, and it's known as, you know, a much more progressive, much more prosperous region in Mexico. I reported there a few months ago and was surprised that, you know, interviewing people there, this was the sending place, where Mexicans are tend to migrate more to California, Texas, and other states. I spent the week there, Rose, and I couldn't find enough Mexicans to say, I'm going to the United States. Yes, I have a job, you know, but they all say, I'm making third world wages. And the reason I'm not going to the United States is not because I found paradise here, but because I don't want to go to a country that's not going to treat me well, or that, you know, that sort of despises me. So I'd rather be here and work here. But at some point, you know, the administration feels, you know, that's going to break. People are going to want more, and people are going to say, you know, enough of this inequality.
Right.
Much like we're seeing in Chile.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to cover this in the coming weeks. According to The Guardian, since the protests erupted on October 19th, there have been 2,410 arrests, 200 of which involved minors. 535 people have been injured, and 18 people at least have died in the violence. The UN says they're going to go to Chile to find out why people are being killed in these demonstrations.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. It's incredible numbers that we're seeing. Mm. And it's a story that, obviously, as foreign correspondents, I mean, we're watching very, very closely.
Right. Today we're speaking with Alfredo Corchado, Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, where he covers U.S. policy in Latin America. He is the author of the new book, Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. Alfredo, you cover very important history in your new book. And, you know, when you sat down to write this book, in addition to telling the story about you and your family specifically, and we'll talk about that a little later in the show, what sort of historical context did you really want to bring to this book?
Well, more than anything, I wanted to write, you know, the universal immigrant story, the story of belonging. And as you look through, I mean, as I'm looking through the whole thing, and the sense of what we had there, I mean, I wanted to pay tribute to the Mexican migrant, you know, the Mexican immigrant, because at the time, I mean, we are living now through a period where we have the lowest flow of Mexican migrants coming to the United States. It's like the big push has ended. You know, it ended in 2007, 2008. So as I was, you know, jotting down my outline, where I was going, I kept thinking, you know, I want to pay tribute to the Mexican, beginning with my mother and father, who to me in many ways symbolized you know, the workers who came over the last 60 years. And as you're doing the I guess the history, you know, you start to realize many things, like, you know, the fact that we came in 1965, around the time that Lyndon B. Johnson passed the Immigration and Nationality Act and reunited many families throughout Latin America. I mean, you just have that sense of history, and you push forward, and at the end of the day, you realize, you know, you live in this incredible country, the United States, which is also a very fickle country. They love you one moment when there's demand, and then they try to deport you the next day when they feel like there's too many of you.
Right. Well, and also, just to sort of put it bluntly, in many cases, they want your very cheap labor, and yet at the same time, they want to keep the country white.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things, one of the passages in the book involved, you know, taking my mother back to Mexico. We try to take her every November, October, for the Day of the Dead celebration. And in this case, I'm asking my mother, I said, do you have any regrets for having left Mexico? And she said, you know, they love you when you're young. They love you when you can do all this work. My mother grew up in the fields of the San Joaquin Valley in California. And this is when they had the short haul. When, I mean, you had to bend over to do the sugar beets and other plants. And she said, but once you start getting old, once there are too many of you, they you know, they're done with you. You're out of here. So, you know, it's that regret, it's that longing for Mexico, and yet realizing that you, as an immigrant, as a population, you have not contributed to any other country as much as you have to the United States. And at the end of the day, you still feel like you live in a country that's very much ungrateful for your services and for what you achieve.
And Alfredo, I have to say, reading your book, it just, so much of the media coverage is on the numbers. You get little snippets of someone's life. I mean, obviously everyone has a story. But I think what really comes out in your book is that there's this push-pull. Because in your case, and we can talk about this in a minute, but, you know, you got a job at the Wall Street Journal, and initially you thought you were a diversity hire until your boss said, you know what, this was in Philadelphia, I want you to go back to El Paso and really do good on-the-ground reporting. And at that point you realized, oh, I'm more than a diversity hire. But even, you know, you, quote, made it, right, by working for the Wall Street Journal, and you still really had such a hard time coming to terms with the fact that your parents brought you to the United States, and where do you fit in?
You know, Ross, I think that's one of the things that a lot of Americans don't realize, that how difficult it is for anyone to migrate, whether it's, you know, the kid today leaving Guatemala or Honduras or Mexico. It's an incredibly hard decision for your parents to make. And for you to you know, to follow them into another country, to leave everything you know, to leave your friends, to leave your grandparents, your relatives, it's a very hard decision. And I wanted to, you know, get that across in the book. You know, the decisions that people make, the sacrifice that they take, it's not easy, and yet you know, you have to do it oftentimes for the economic pull that's pulling you from the United States.
Right, and at the same time, dreaming of where you come from, the cobblestone streets, the smells, the food, and you're in such a difficult predicament because the United States has its iron fist on your country, and you're also dealing in many ways with a government that's corrupt. So, I mean, there's so many layers to this, and it really comes out in your book.
So you end up living on the border where you don't really have to choose anymore.
Right.
But, you know, all seriously, I mean, I feel that in many ways, you know, going to Philadelphia made me more Mexican than I think if I would have stayed on the border, because of the friends. You know, one friend was a labor organizer, another friend ended up becoming a tequila connoisseur and Mexican food connoisseur, and the other one an attorney. I mean, but we were all, you know, holed up in this little restaurant in Philadelphia called Tequila's. We were all nostalgic. We were all lonely. And I think because of that, you know, we just became closer and closer to Mexico. I mean, my friend David Zuro, the tequila owner, everything he has in that restaurant is from Mexico, whether it's the chairs, the plates, the bar, et cetera. It's all from Mexico. And so that made us, I think, at the end of the day, it made us more Mexicans than we probably would have become in any other place.
There's so many great scenes in the book that take place in the restaurant Tequila's. And when you heard that there was this Mexican restaurant in Philadelphia, you were very skeptical. You walked in and there were photos of revolutionaries on the wall, and you kind of rolled your eyes thinking, okay, they're playing the part. But who knew? They were incredibly authentic, and the owner became one of your dear friends.
Yeah, I mean, I'm working for the Wall Street Journal, and my very first job is to cover consumer issues, you know, Black & Decker, Hershey bars, et cetera. And so I'm learning about American marketing. And when they told me there was a restaurant called Tequila's, it's a Mexican restaurant, I thought to myself, it's probably part of a franchise, like a Chi-Chi's. And so I walked in, you know, very cynical, very skeptical. And even David Zuro, at my first sight of him, I thought, you know, this guy has to be Italian, pretending to be Mexican. This guy is a fake Mexican.
How did those guys respond to your book?
Very good. I mean, I'm very grateful to the three of them who were incredibly, I think at the beginning when I said I'm going to write a book and it's going to be centered around my four friends, they all thought, you know, they looked at me and thought, you know, that who cares? I mean, that's not going to be a book. So they just kind of played along with me. Sure. When they realized it was serious, because when I started asking for, you know, letters or pictures, you know, correspondence that we had back then, even emails in more modern day, they got a little more serious, and I said, look, I'm going to make sure that you read everything I write. Not for you to edit or control, you know, whatever I write, but to make sure it's accurate, to make sure it's fair. And in that respect, I mean, they were incredibly supportive of the book.
What about your family? Your mom brought you to the United States from the Mexican state of Durango in 1966 when you were just five. Your father picked cantaloupes in California's Central Valley. This was part of the Bracero guest program. For more than two decades, beginning in the 40s, that program brought a number of Mexicans to work in the U.S. on temporary contracts. And then, as you said, your mom did backbreaking work in the fields. So what does your family think of your book?
My family was very shocked when I wrote Midnight in Mexico, because they realized that my going back to Mexico also involved covering drug traffickers and so forth. So when I showed them the second book, Homelands, Patrias in Spanish, they were both very nervous, like, oh my God, what are we going to find out here? And it was very emotional for me to watch them, you know, read the book, and then, you know, as they were trying to grapple with their own emotions, I mean, crying and so forth. And I can't really explain the sense of pride they felt, and the sense of that I had finally accomplished something by telling the story, and which is really the story of 35 million Mexican Americans in this country. I mean, they're not unique. You know, there are millions of them who have very similar stories.
Right. Today we're speaking with Alfredo Corchado, Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, and he's out with a great new book called Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. Alfredo, you also write a lot about history. And one thing that stood out for me is when you wrote about the Simpson-Rodino Act, as IRCA was originally known. It passed with the help of the Reagan administration. Senator Alan Simpson, a Republican from Wyoming, lacked the votes in 86 to pass a reform bill without making a compromise on the so-called one-time-only amnesty. What strikes me about this, Alfredo, is there are a lot of videos and memes, and a lot of liberals share these and say, hey, look, even Ronald Reagan supported amnesty. And as you report in this book, the Reagan administration had an interest in protecting recent immigrants, not for altruistic motives, but for political ones. Tell us, what was the political motive?
Well, there was a lot. I mean, one of the things that's happened throughout history is that, you know, you pass something like amnesty, but then you also harden the border. You increase security. I think in this case, there was also the situation in Central America. You know, they were trying to control the Central American flow and have the remittances, you know, go back and forth to help their own altruistic plans in that region.
And you write that one of them is during the 80s, nearly a million refugees from El Salvador were sending about $3 million a day back to their relatives in the war-torn country. And these remittances played a key role in propping up a U.S. ally defending itself against the Marxist insurgents who would undermine Reagan's Cold War tactics. Now, when I see these memes and these videos, there's nothing about this.
Right. I mean, that's the thing about, you know, journalism and writing a book. I mean, you have more time. You do a lot more searching. I mean, there are a lot of things, you know, when you take time and you look at this, you go, okay, it's not all black and white. I mean, there's always something in it for the United States. And I guess anyone who hears me says, well, obviously, you know, dumb. It's obviously true. But, I mean, it is surprising to read that. And it's also, I guess, not that surprising. I mean, you have to find a way to push your own policy, and in this sense, it was the Reagan administration pushing their policy on Central America.
You also have information about the impact that NAFTA had on Mexican farmers and workers. We've done a lot of shows about that. In doing your research, what really stood out for you?
How that really, I mean, again, you go to El Bajío. I've always been fascinated by El Bajío in Mexico. It's the whole region, you know, the states of Aguascalientes, Guanajuato, Michoacán, San Luis Potosí. How, the, you know, this region was back then, you know, more prosperous too, but you had a lot of farmers just close up shop and leave. Mm. And you know, they sold their things and went to the United States. The other thing was sobering was the number of women who just began to migrate. And it's my uncle, Antonio, in my hometown of San Luis Ecuador, Durango, once warned me, he said, when the women leave, the community dies. Mm. Everybody leaves. The kids leave. The children leave. I mean, everybody. It changes the whole makeup of the town. And as I travel through Mexico, I see more on that, and I always remember my uncle's advice or a warning. But I also see today, you know, more and more Mexicans who are returning back to their homeland. Hmm. They're aging, you know, in retirement, and they're trying to, I guess, you know, find a place that's more welcoming than the United States.
Wow. Well, Alfredo, before we let you go, what story or stories are you working on now?
Well, the story I'm working on right now is really, I mean, it's twofold. One is looking at the continued policies that we see on the border, and we know, as you know, that things are probably going to get worse in the weeks, months to come, especially with this impeachment and going back in Washington.
Right.
Again, you know, the Trump administration usually goes back to the border to try to drum up support, and so there's talk that the wall is actually being constructed now, so that's something that we're watching very closely. And you can't get away from the fact that the shooter came to El Paso and tried to erase the history of 35 million Mexican Americans, you know, who were trying to come across what we now know as the Ellis Island of the Southwest. So that story is going to continue on for weeks, months, if not years to come.
Well, Alfredo, as always, thank you for your reporting. I really did enjoy learning more about you and your family. And thank you for writing this great book.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you all to your listeners, and good luck on the fundraising.
Thank you so much. Alfredo Corchado is Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, where he covers U.S. policy in Latin America, and author of a fantastic new book, Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.